Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Ham Nation is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Ham Nation, episode number 15, recorded August 30th, 2011, when all else fails. Hey, everybody. Ham Nation is on the air. Oh, no, wait a minute. Time out. Because I'm not sure if it's a legitimate thing to say that we're on the air.
No.
I need an official reading on this. Leo, W6TWT, this is KN4AQ. Do you copy? Over.
I copy you, KN4AQ. I think we're not on the air. We're more like on the packets. I don't know what we call it. We're on the internet.
Well, you know, like the cable news outfits, they say they're on the air.
That's
and they're
true.
Not on the air.
No, there's
no
air involved.
And technically, we're not on the air.
No.
But technically, because of all the people that are watching on Wi-Fi,
true.
And 3G and 4G and
true.
Stuff, we're technically on the air. But, you know, that's not what people think of. They're thinking 100 kilowatt transmitters on the 2,000 foot towers or the mountaintops and stuff. So, but this is ham radio. I think we're going to call it, we're on the air. So let me rewind a little bit and try again. Ham Nation is on the air.
Yes.
Okay.
It's great to see you. Gary is filling in for Bob Heil, who is somewhere in Italy right now, I think.
Actually, he's either in there. The air.
He's in the air.
I have a theory about where Bob Heil is.
Uh-huh.
I think that you have kidnapped him, put him down in the basement at TWiT, and you're having him wire new connections.
He can't get out till I can get HF. No, Bob is isn't he, Gordon? Isn't he on his way to a cruise around Venice or something like that?
I think he is. He's going to meet Marconi and the whole gang back there.
He's not selling microphones. He's just goofing off.
Yeah, he's having a little vacation, and I think he deserves some fun. But we're so glad you could join us, Gary. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
It is my pleasure to be here. I've been a ham since 1965, so I've got a little water under the bridge. Professionally, I've been doing radio and television, mostly production, a little bit of disc jockeying here and there, a little bit of professional voiceover announcing when I can get it, but mostly pushing buttons on the other side of the glass. But it's a lot of fun to show up here on this side and play in front of the microphone. I really enjoy doing that.
Well, we've got a great show planned, I know. You're here in a good time.
Yep, and I do a little ham radio video production company called Amateur Radio Video News. It's a DVD distribution system, so I'm kind of, you know, fully back into the 1990s with it. But I'll run out and shoot some programs and come back and edit them and eventually get them out as DVDs. You got a handful of them there. I don't know if you've had a chance to see any of those.
I do, and they're great. It's really cool what you do. And I think for a lot of us, being able to watch a video on TV is a better way than, or certainly a good adjunct to reading manuals and all those books. Boy, studying Gordo, studying for those tests, I just my eyes are blurry. So anything I can do to relax and either listen to Gordo CDs or watch your DVDs is good.
Well, this has been quite a week in the world, in the eastern part of the United States, in ham radio. With that hurricane that blew up, it started here, landfall in North Carolina. It turned out not to be quite as bad as everyone was expecting, but it still killed several people and has caused a lot of damage. And we have a guest on the program tonight from at ARL headquarters, Mike Corey, W5MPC. Mike is their emergency preparedness manager, and I understand he has been pretty much without sleep since sometime on Friday. So we're going to be talking to Mike about the activities that have occurred all up and down the East Coast and how ARL has fit in with it. And then a little bit later on, we'll talk to Don Arnold, W6GPS. And Don is an APRS expert and has some APRS toys. And I think his focus is also going to be on emergency communications and where APRS can fit into that. And then finally, we'll get George. And George Thomas has some more emergency activity with smoke and solder. He has got some emergency equipment to show for the smoke and solder segment. So it's an all-hurricane, all-emergency show. So flash the red lights and sound the siren. It's an emergency show.
We're here. This is when hams really stepped forward. And actually, you know, it turned out Vermont was one of the places that really got hard hit kind of unexpectedly. And that's the problem with emergencies. You never can plan for those, can you?
And ARRL headquarters is right up in Newington, Connecticut. The hurricane went just to their west, and a lot of the territory up there has been without power. I think the headquarters has got plenty of backup power, and I think things are working there now, but Mike will have a chance to tell us all about that. And I don't know, Leo, if you're ready, we can go pick up Mike and talk to him a little
bit. I think we've got him on the line. Mike, are you there?
Yeah, hi, guys. How you doing?
Well, welcome. We'll get you some sleep in just a little bit. Do you get to rest soon, I hope?
Yeah, fortunately, no storms coming and Labor Day weekend coming up, so hopefully a little time to relax, have some downtime, and take care of some. We did have a little bit of damage from the storm, and take care of some of that, get things cleaned up a bit.
So, Mike, I guess the whole idea here is that ham radio is there in emergencies. It is something that is very difficult to turn off. I guess the phrase that we're using is when all else fails. And I think you probably had your finger on the pulse of ham radio activity over the course of the weekend during Hurricane Irene, as well or better than anybody else. So tell us a little bit about what you have been participating in for the past couple of days.
Okay. Yeah, it started really about a week ago when we first started seeing that the forecast tracks were going to be taking the hurricane up the East Coast. Last week, we began communicating with our section officials, our section managers, and section emergency coordinators. Altogether, we're dealing with 17 sections in the path of this storm, sending out daily emails. We held a couple conference calls to see where everybody was at with their planning. Started getting updates from the sections as they were going into standby mode and going active in various state EOCs. We also started talking with our served agencies at the national level, with Red Cross, with Saturn, the National Weather Service, National Hurricane Center, and kind of keeping tabs on what they were doing. We also worked very closely over the weekend with Hurricane WatchNet and were able to submit some reports to them. As the storm progressed, we had one last conference call on Friday night, and then we hunkered down and got ready for it. And over the weekend, put W1AW on the air. We monitored some of the traffic nets that were going on, checked in with Hurricane Watch Net, with National Weather Service through their Taunton, Massachusetts office, checked in with the Saturn Net, and generally just kept tabs on what was going on. And I think that the chance that folks had to have several days to get ready and some early action on the part of Aries groups and the sections and some of the actions here at headquarters really helped get us prepared to step in when called. And I'm slowly getting some reports coming in of some of the activities that that folks were involved in. And, you know, we did good. We did what we were supposed to do. We were ready when the call came out. And in some cases, that call was answered. And amateur radio came in, and we did what we do best. We helped fill that gap and provided communications.
So there's three phases of a typical operation in something like this, where we have, first of all, where we have some advance notice of the hurricane. There is the preparation when you see it coming. There is the actual event, and then finally there's the recovery. And give me a little bit of information about what ham radio's role is in each of those. Do we have any actual on-air activity as a hurricane is approaching?
Yeah, and one of the first things you want, that whether it be a local Aries group or the amateurs that are involved with providing communications at a state EOC, you start testing your systems. You make sure that everything is working. I mean, this should be going on long before a hurricane is forecasted to come. Some emergencies situations don't give you this much warning. A good example is the earthquake in Virginia just last week. we started doing this as well. Even W1AW, we checked in with Hurricane WatchNet ahead of time, make sure that we could get checked in, check propagation, you know, take all these steps so that way when you actually have to key the mic, when it actually happens, you've got a good idea as to that you will that you'll be able to make those connections that you need to make. The preparedness doesn't really stop. You know, it's an ongoing activity, and it's not just for amateur radio. Really, all of us have to take those steps. When we go into that on the air, boots on the ground mode, it's time to go. You know, that's where everything we've done before is going to come to light. If we didn't take the time to plan, didn't take the time to prepare, make sure our equipment is in order, make sure ourselves are in order. That's an important part. That's a key part. You know, the individual needs to make sure that they are ready to go. You know, it all gets brought to light during the emergency. And, you know, and that's what we look for in the aftermath. That's what we're in the phase where some of us are in now. As you pointed out, in Vermont, New York, and some other places, they're still dealing with the flooding. Here in Connecticut, there are communities that are also still dealing with that. But as we go into that after the event phase, that's when we start looking at what worked, what didn't work, solutions to the things that didn't work. And, you know, the key to that is I heard this phrased best by a representative of FEMA that I met in Louisiana during Hurricane Gustav. He said, lessons learned is fine, but it's lessons applied that really count. You know, if you don't learn from your lessons, and if you don't take those lessons to heart and apply them, then the lessons learned is a wasted effort. So, you know, this is a continual process. And, you know, whether you're actively involved in amateur radio emergency communications or you're involved in another aspect of the hobby, whether it be DXing, contesting, or whatever else, it's a continual effort on all our parts.
So when the hurricane is actually passing overhead, does ham radio have a role right at that time? I mean, I sort of think in our public perception, we kind of go running in, antennas waving to save the day. Not so much.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I can draw on just a couple experiences, one that I've seen this weekend. First, the role of the amateur radio and the EOC as the hurricane is happening, it's absolutely critical. You take certain measures ahead of the storm. They're making landfall. I'm drawing on some experience I had in an EOC in Louisiana with Hurricane Gustav. As the storm is happening, you know, it's you're already gearing up for that next step. You're assessing, you know, the damage in the area. You're calling in reports. There's continually reports to be called in. You know, you try not to lose contact. In the case of the EOC I was in, we were trying not to lose contact with the state EOC. But, you know, there's another thing that happens as the storm makes landfall, as it's passing overhead and as it's trailing away. And, you know, and each segment of that storm has different characteristics to it. Which you have to anticipate for. But one of the key roles amateur radio operators can play a part in, and it's one of the best things we can do, is relaying current weather data into either the National Hurricane Center through Hurricane WatchNet or WX4NHC, or by relaying weather data through their local weather forecast office with the National Weather Service. You know, we can. Many amateurs have weather stations either at their own station or close by, and they can get a lot of real-time data and observations to report, and that is key as the storm makes landfall. It helps the meteorologist get a better idea as to the effect that the storm is having on people and property.
The Hurricane WatchNet operates on 14.325, and they are from Miami. And propagation being what it is on 20 meters, sometimes there's some big, long skip zones where signals aren't audible. So they get some help, I guess, from stations farther out west, depending on what territory they need to cover. And I always hear them looking for stations with reports from the affected area. And I don't really hear that many. Do they get a significant amount of information from ham radio at this point?
Yeah. And, you know, one thing to point out is that the Hurricane WatchNet has net control operators scattered throughout the country that can help relay these reports in to NHC in Miami. They also, in the case of Irene, also operated on 40 meters when propagation wasn't favorable on 20. And you combine that with the efforts of BOIP WeatherNet and the EchoLink service, it provides many different avenues for the information to come in. And as the storm is making landfall, they are getting regular reports. While we were observing at W1AW this weekend was a large number of reports coming in locally out here in New England from quite a few different sources. Same with Hurricane WatchNet. The reports were coming in, I think, at a pretty steady clip.
The National Weather Service offices in each area have VHF nets typically on some of the wide area repeaters, and they'll be looking for information from hams. And, of course, you can't hear that around the country. You can only hear it in the local area typically. So that's probably where the hams are busiest, is in their local areas on VHF. The communications infrastructure is getting more elaborate and probably stronger. Here in North Carolina, 15, 20 years ago, hurricane came through like this, a lot of local communications would be disrupted. This time, I'm not aware of any call-outs of ham radio operators to go into areas where communications had failed. Did you see very much of that in the immediate aftermath? And are there some ham operations going on up in your area that are currently supplying communications where other systems are not working?
This storm is one that it seemed to have a less severe impact on normal means of communication, although I've gotten a couple reports, and I'm still kind of sifting through some information that's coming in. But I have gotten a couple reports where amateurs are assisting with providing communications where the normal means have been affected. But, you know, something to point out with the National Weather Service offices is that while primarily they are relying on the on VHF nets, and occasionally you may find HF nets that are relaying information in. Modes such as EchoLink and IRLP have also played a big part in this, and it allows, a forecast office that has a very wide county warning area to receive reports where there may not be VHF coverage. And, you know, this is one of those areas that even though normal means of communication for receiving weather information, storm chasers, meteorologists themselves, the public submitting reports either online or via phone, amateur radio is not just, this is one of the roles where we are part of the normal means of communication to receive those reports. So, you know, that's a key thing when it comes to severe weather events such as a hurricane, is that, you know, we are part of a communications network for critical information.
In the aftermath, hams, if there's a communications outage someplace, hams will help fill in. We've been seeing a lot of hams, a lot of new hams getting into our hobby with specific interest in providing emergency communications. I don't know if they know exactly what kinds of things they'll be getting into. Would you say it's exciting or kind of tedious, having been up for many, many hours in a row?
It can be tedious. This isn't nearly as bad as the last hurricane. I helped out with Hurricane Gustav. That one I was at the EOC for 5 days. Emergency communications, particularly for a hurricane, can be very taxing. I know the four of us that were over there definitely learned that lesson. In fact, one of them that was one of the operators at W1AW this weekend was Sean Kutzko, KX9X, our contest branch manager. And I think Sean learned quite a bit about emergency communications over the 36 hours he was there. But the one thing I do have to say, for the hams that are getting their license for the purpose of emergency communications, that is it's an outstanding area of the amateur radio service that can draw folks in, but they shouldn't stop there. I've never been a fan of those that say, I'm only. I only do this for emergency communications. You know, a true emergency may only exist 1% of the time, and you're going to spend 99% of your time planning for something, preparing for something, But the key is you spend 99% of time it should be spent being active with the amateur radio service. I often say when I talk to groups, what makes us such an asset for emergency communications? Is it our license? No, if by that logic, our driver's license makes us IndyCar racers. Is it all the certificates we have hanging on the wall for all the training we've completed? No, training is important, but that is not what makes us a true asset. Is it I always call them the survivor vest and the Batman belt and the bandolier of HTs. I hope nobody is out there wearing a bandolier of HTs, but
I got that two. That's a start.
But that, too, is not what makes us an asset. What makes us a true asset is our comprehensive knowledge of the amateur radio service. We're called in as communicators, and we don't get that knowledge and that experience and that expertise by waiting for an emergency. We get that knowledge, that experience, and that expertise by being active in the service. And that's the first thing I encourage anybody that says, I got my license to get involved in emergency communications. I'm like, great. Now get involved in some other things. Get involved with your club. Get involved with field day. Get on the air for a contest. And that's really the key right there. Get on the air. That's an absolute key for emergency communications. That's the other side of it on what makes us an asset is we've got the frequencies that allow us to do this. And we're not going to have them if we don't use them. That's one of those. It's a responsibility for everybody that holds an amateur radio license. Get on the air, get active, because that's what is really it makes it possible to do what we do.
And that's how you learn to use your equipment. That's how you learn to understand what to expect: propagation, repeater coverage, repeater frequencies that you might need to use. You have to use this stuff, and I think our value is that we use it every day. If we were just here for emergencies, we wouldn't be here because there wouldn't be enough to do. The W1AW station is the headquarters station, the Maxim Memorial Station up there in Newington, just outside of Hartford. And this idea of W1AW being on the air during emergencies is relatively new over the past few years. How's that working out? How did that happen?
It actually goes back a lot further. W1AW has played a role in a lot of emergency events over almost a 100-year history. Katrina really taught us a lesson on utilizing W1AW as a resource for the field organization. And that's something that we put to use a few other times since. Hurricane Gustav, Hurricane Ike, and this week with Irene. W1AW is a resource for the field. Whether the event affects Connecticut, in this case it did, there is somewhat of a local aspect to Irene. But even during Katrina, W1AW is a resource. It can serve as anybody that's seen W1AW and ever guest stopped from the station knows that it is an amazing station. It's on all bands, all modes, it's really a showcase of amateur radio. But W1AW is a great resource to serve as to relay. Again, it's the American Radio Relay League. That's one of those great things W1AW can do to assist nets in operation. Make reports, submit reports as we did this weekend to the Hurricane Watch Net. Also help relay traffic. We've got EchoLink capability, D-Star capability, WinLink. There's a lot of resources available there for the field organization, particularly in an event such as Irene, Katrina, Ike. And of course, we also have to look at other natural hazard threats that are out there. This winter in New England was a particularly rough winter for a lot of states. And we've got very active earthquake zones in the U.S. as well. This is a resource for the field organization that they can utilize. And for events of the scope of a hurricane or a major earthquake, and most events can be handled locally, but occasionally an event will come along that you do need to bring in some extra support on the air.
Let's see if Gordon or Leo had anything that they want to toss in, guys.
Sure. Go ahead, Leo. You go first.
I don't have any questions. I'm just fascinated learning about this. This is all new to me, and it is something that I think people immediately think of hams. They think of emergency services, and I can see how important that is to ham operation. But I liked it when you said just get on the air, not worry about that yet, because you can't be emergencies all the time. Gordon, you're wearing your obviously your emergency services uniform there. You're very active in this.
We are, and we absolutely agree that getting on the air is absolutely critical to becoming a good, not only great amateur operator to the service and the hobby, but also taking part in emergency comms. The American Radio Relay League offers great training for emergency communicators. It is both training on the internet as well as reading book, comm course, up with an ID card that certifies that you passed it. And for those that are interested, go to ARRL.org and learn more about their new MCOM emergency course. But you know, we all agree that getting on the air is what really makes a good ham radio operator right agency. And
I'm sorry, and, go ahead.
When the agency makes the call up, we encourage all the to wear your uniform. Don't go in with a pair of dungarees and a dirty, but rather come in, serve, and looking like a professional communicator. We'll have you around for several days during the big one.
Hey, Gordon, I'm wondering if you have a loose connection there on your mic, because you're cutting in and out a little bit as if the connection is a little bit loose. I don't know if there's something.
Okay, there we go, and hopefully that'll make a difference.
bang that equipment a little bit there.
No, I cat was walking on it.
Tuning him.
But we just encourage.
Yeah, I've got a suggestion for people to get practice doing emergency communications, which doesn't really come around all that often. Something that does come around probably in your area all the time, several a year, are these big public service events, bike tours, walkathons. These can be really huge communications events. They're not necessarily emergencies, but most of them use ham radio support, some of them very critically. Right. We do all their logistics. I know there's a big one coming up here in North Carolina for the MS Society. And they'll have dozens of hams helping out. It keeps the repeater frequency very, very busy all day long. It is excellent training and experience in, if not exactly emergency communications, at least controlled chaos communications, so that you
that's right.
are getting good preparation for what it will be like when there's an emergency. Well, I want to toss it back to Mike one more time. And Mike, we may have intrigued some people who are hams but have not participated much in emergencies, or some people who are not yet hams but have had that thought in the back of their mind. What's their next step? If a ham wants to get into emergency communications but hasn't been so far, what do they do and where do they go?
Well, I think the one thing I do need to follow up with your comment on public service is, you know, public service is one of those areas that we really, really shine in. This is a chance for us to work with our community and our served agencies under normal conditions, and that's absolutely key. We need to remember that is really part of ARES, that is part of MCOM. It's not all MCOM, it's MCOM and public service. So that is key. As far as new hams on what the next steps are, first off, I would definitely recommend picking up a couple books that the league makes available, the Emergency Communications Handbook. I can't help but to for those interested in Skywarn and storm spotting, that is another side to MCOM, as we've talked about. Another book out there is Storm Spotting and Amateur Radio, and I would also encourage try the Emergency Communications Level 1 course. Even if your interest is just at a very basic level, it's a good overview on what we do, why we do it, and how we do the things that we do. I would also really encourage find a good Elmer. You know, we all can think of that Elmer that really helped us in our amateur radio career, but there are good MCOM Elmers out there. Check your local club, check your local ARES group, and look for those that can kind of show you the ropes. I think
this is a very local thing. It's it's absolutely not run out of Dillington. It's run out of your town.
I'm sitting surrounded by our local Petaluma CERT volunteers, and they're all going to Elmer me, right? You're going to help me get involved in this.
That's terrific.
Yeah, it's exciting, and we have a great, of course, thanks to ICOM, a great station here, and I really want to take advantage of that and use it to help out with MCOM here in our area.
So, Mike, we've got to wrap up this segment with you, and thank you very much for participating, and I think we'll probably be seeing more from folks up there at headquarters here on Ham Nation as the weeks go by. Thank you very much for coming by.
Thanks, guys, and I just want to close real quick by saying, you know, I would be completely remiss if I didn't take this opportunity to say a very heartfelt thank you to our field organization and the ARES members that have responded to Irene. You did the brunt of the work. You did a fantastic job from everything that I've heard. And, you know, for those that are out there, the boots on the ground, keep up the good work. You know, you do a great job and you're doing a great, great service for your community.
Thank you,
all
Mike.
Right. Thanks, Mike.
That's Mike.
Thanks,
Corey.
Guys.
And we're going to talk to Don Arnold in a minute, but we got to do a Skype switch on the fly there. We'll tax the TWIT technicians as they push the buttons. And in the meantime, we're going to take a look at some email that you guys have been sending us. And Gordon, I think you've got a little bit there.
I do, from Mike India 3, Zulu Juliet Tango. That must be like the Netherlands or somewhere like that. He says, we need to talk more about Echolink and kids and ham radio. And yes, we've got some upcoming stories that we're going to do about kids and some of the digital modes. And Rick KF7RID says, I live in an apartment. Have I had it on being able to get an antenna up? No. On October 18th, we're going to have a special Ham Nation broadcast all about putting antennas secretly in your condo. And that's Terry, W0FM, who worked 300 countries on an inside-the-apartment antenna. Of course, their cats and dogs have no more fur, but other than that, they're good to go. Bob, WA8YCD, says he wants George to put on a magnifying glass and show us all how to solder surface mount technology. These are little components that all of you know are smaller than ants. I don't know about that.
And George told Someone me he asked, could do it. George said he could do it, so we're going to make
yeah,
him do
all
it.
All right. Well, that's good, and we're going to see George in just a moment. And several of you asked about the glass sign with our call sign on it. That comes from Jim's Engraving. That's J-I-M-S Engraving. Jim has been nice enough, and some of the proceeds help the military, so God bless Jim.
Finally, I want to thank you, Gordo, and Jim, too, for my W6TWT sign of hanging up over the station there. It looks beautiful.
All right. Well, I think we're almost ready to learn more about emergency comms. And, you know, Mike was talking about the digital modes and identifying where folks are. And Don Arnold, W6GPS, is going to give us a live demonstration of automatic position reporting system. Look at that. Donnie's in his
car. He's in his car.
So I'm in the mobile. All right. Having a fun with the bugs here. The bugs are closing in on the light, but I want to say good day to everybody and Ham Nation, and I want to just take a few minutes, talk a little bit about APRS, and just want to say hello to everybody.
Don's world famous. He's W6GPS, does those great YouTube videos. I've learned a lot from your stuff, Don, so I thank you, and it's great to have you on the show today.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much, and if you got 30 seconds, I'll tell you one of my hurricane stories.
Go ahead.
Back in Hurricane Hugo days, the organization I worked for had a college down in St. Thomas, and for 2 days we could not get word that we had no idea what was wrong down there. They actually threw me on an airplane. I packed my ham radio, had a little dipole antenna, got off in St. Thomas, hitched a ride to the far end of the island, and paid the guy $25 to use his battery on his car, use his car as a ground plane, and literally put up my Outbacker antenna, called in on a hurricane net, had health and welfare traffic, and basically our organization wanted to know if everybody was alive, and in 5 minutes we had the questions answered, and I'll never forget the look on that guy's face when the ham radio guy in 5 minutes was on the air with his HF, and that's kind of my ham radio story from the receiving end.
All right.
Yeah, that's what we do. We get in there when nobody else can and get things going fast. Not We can't replace the phone company. You know, we don't have that kind of bandwidth, but we can get that first handful of messages through hours, maybe a day before anybody else can.
When I got that technician license, Don, I asked Gordo, what handy talkie should I get? And he said, get this Kenwood D72A, because it's got APRS built into it. And that's the, what is that, automatic position relay system? Is that what that stands for?
It's actually automatic packet reporting system.
Okay.
It could be, but it also, some people use it as automatic position reporting system. When it first came out back in the early 90s, they call it automatic packet reporting system. But then when they added the GPS and to give latitude and longitude or localization, then they changed it to automatic position reporting system.
But it does so much more than position reporting, doesn't it? I mean, it's not just GPS by any means.
Yeah, they changed it back. If Bob Berninga is watching, he's spinning right now. I'll help him out. They changed it back to automatic packet reporting system.
Rightly so.
Don, I'm sure you know this, but when Bob does a talk, he says, it's not just a position reporting system.
It does a lot more.
Oh yeah, and I did a video on Bob, and it was kind of interesting listening to him talk. But we will change all of our information to automatic packet reporting packet. System if that's the way it should be.
Packet.
But we know what everybody uses it for.
GPS.
Oh, absolutely.
Hey, Donnie, we want to see this gear in action. How about showing us what that stuff can do?
Okay, first of all, I'm using in my car, and I have to admit the neighbors are most excited by all the lighting equipment and everything, but right now I'm using a Kenwood D710, and it's hooked up to my AVMAP, and I might also add that 710, besides all the APRS functions, in a whole different segment of Ham Nation, we'll talk about EchoLink because it does EchoLink. So there's a lot of things that will that radio will do, and also Leo, your handy talkie, it will do EchoLink also.
I know I've done EchoLink on it, and I've got mine hooked up to the AV map as well. But, you know, it's funny because this AV map reminds me of a GPS unit, really, like an in-car GPS. If you get the overhead shot, John, you can see. But there's more than just a map on it. It's also got little icons. Yeah.
Right. Well, you've got some point of interest icons, and I've got a little close up here in my car, and you can see there's
call
some
signs. Activity.
There's call signs and repeat.
Oh, you got call signs, Donnie.
Right. Yeah. Okay. And what we call those is waypoints or beacon positions, and you can see that on the data screen. I'll try to get here a little bit better here. And pardon me for, you know, I'm in a car. I am not driving, but I am wearing my seatbelt. But over here on the data, I've set up a position. And what's unique about the AVMAP is I have set myself up to track myself with this other icon. There's a flip window, and that right there is a position that I put on the map, and I also have a off-road routing to it. So you see that 134 miles. Now, that's a fictitious position that I generated to put in there. But if I move and change locations, that distance will change. And the latitude, longitude, all those data are the call sign that I want to track. And so that's kind of a valuable tool if you're chasing a balloon or if you're in search and rescue, if you want to track a moving APRS station. And so when you flip back, this is my actual sorry about the focus there. There you go. There's my fixed position. So you could be navigating down the road. You could be chasing your target and then flipping to the other page so that you could keep an eye on your station that you want to keep track of.
Wow, I hope, that, That's really something. So, Don, emergency communicators then could actually outfit their folks with the GPS equipment, Kenwood, Yaesu, ICOM, and be able to look at them on maybe a computer and see where those operators are during the emergency?
Absolutely. APRS is, there's two types of systems. There's the RF system where you have a handy talking to another handy talking. I got a whole bunch of stuff here, but you have two handy talkies sending position information to each other. And then you can also use the computer network. And there's a thing called an eye gate. And if you're close to an eye gate, when you transmit your APRS information, it actually goes into the guy's computer, the ham station that has a computer there, and spits it into the APRS network. Now, the best website that I've found to find a lot of information is aprs.fi, aprs.fi. In fact, after the show, if you folks go
Bingo.
To APRS, there you go, right there.
Oh,
this,
wow.
This is us. This is us locally right here, and you can see all the beaconing call signs. And there's some weather stations. See those WX icons? That's another thing people do, right?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, on Saturday, the last Saturday when the hurricane was making tracks up the coast, I took my digital camera, I got on APRS.fi, and I shot a series of photographs just to get some tactical information, weather information, as the hurricane was making a move. Now, I'm not a weatherman, but I do know that when the barometric pressure goes lower, that means that the storm is going to be more violent or have more energy in it. So as the storm was getting closer to Norfolk, I was able to see the millibars go down. Also, I could see the wind location and things like that. So, like I said, I had some pictures that I sent up to you folks there showing that kind of information.
Yeah, we have those here. I was just kind of amazed at the number of people using APRS here in the San Francisco Bay Area. The map is loaded and a ton of weather stations. So you really get a lot of granular weather information.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And if you were to maybe go up there to the Presidio area and just click on a weather WX icon and open it up, you would see kind of what the local weather is.
I can scroll down here. I can see San Quentin. I can see Larkspur. Let's go to the Presidio area and see here. Here's a so I just click on that, and I can get the weather information right there.
Oh, wow. Look at that.
Yeah.
Isn't that cool?
So
better than the TV station.
Much better. Well, you can see every neighborhood.
That's right.
And the thing, Leo, is a lot of people use APRS for just tracking. And Bob would really emphasize it's not just tracking, it's status. It's things that are going on in that area. For example, the Boston Marathon, they use APRS stations to get a status of runners and all sorts of things. The your imagination is, you could do just about anything that you could think of using this status. But for emergency communications, after I was kind of checking the weather there in North Carolina, I moved up to the Norfolk area, and I saw where the shelter icons, the positions were indicated on the map.
Wow.
And those shelter icons gave the location of where the shelters were. So if a person had APRS, they could find that shelter station. Also, the Red Cross and other disaster preparedness groups use APRS to communicate, to give a status, to send messages. And back to the earthquake in Virginia, I had six phone numbers that I tried to call just to see how my friends were, and the whole phone system up through Virginia was just shut down. So when the big event happens, again, amateur radio is going to be a part of it, where people on the microphones and talking and listening and taking down information is one thing of amateur radio. Another aspect is a visual information that you get from APRS. And I every day I learn something. It's extremely interesting. And some of the most unique things that you can do with it that people hadn't even conjured up yet.
Here's some of the maps that you sent us. This is the storm track from Irene. I'm not sure where you got these pictures, but these are pretty impressive pictures here. You could follow the storm track. You could see.
Yep, right up there. I just took those right with my my digital camera right off my computer.
So this is APRS.fi right here.
Yeah. That's correct.
Wow. And a lot of balloon launches have APRS on them. And you can follow their tracks on APRS.fi if you know they're going on.
I got some email from one of our viewers who does exactly that. In fact, I think he sent me a link, if I can find it here, to some of his balloon launches, which is pretty cool. I can think of a lot of things you might do with this.
Sure. I've got some video at Dayton of, I think it's WAAELK balloon launches, and it's very, very fascinating. Everybody getting their radios out there.
Yeah, this is Greg Burnett, W0GRB, who sent me. There's a track, for instance, of a balloon launch.
Look at that.
Yeah. Yeah. Really cool. Neat stuff.
And Bill Brown, ELK, is going to be on our show in about another month from now using APRS and showing us an actual balloon launch on ham radio.
They also take pictures with those balloon launches up there and get some amazing images from practically space.
Well, Donnie, thanks so much for being there in your mobile. Now, Don, are you going to drive around so after
we can
our cast, we can watch and see how fast you're going?
Absolutely. As soon as I get off the show, you could go to APRS.fi in the tracking window, put W6GPS in there, and you can check my speed and you could see my direction. So when we wrap out of here, I got to move my lights, but I'll kind of drive around for a little bit and give you guys something to look at. But anyway, it is very interesting. APRS.fi has added a whole lot of new features, just things that I was discovering on Saturday to where you could filter out one set of APRS stations. So I figured out how to just have nothing but weather stations. And but it was just interesting looking all through the area as the hurricane was going up to see everything start popping up and how people were moving and how resources were being utilized. So it's very, very, very unique medium, very, very user friendly. You know, you can use like your D72, which is a great radio, but you can also get an inexpensive handy talkie and get a, let's see if I get it upside right side up here, but you could get yourself a tiny track, which is a little TNC, terminal node controller, to take your information and spit it out the radio. So there's all sorts of ways that you can do it. Some guys do it the most cheapest ways, and it's very, very effective. And that's part of the hobby is tinkering and getting something to work to where it could be utilized for a specific need.
All right, Donnie. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. Now, listen, Don, be sure and unplug before you start driving around. We don't want you running that halogen lamp around. Donnie, thanks. Donnie is the one that got Susie and I squared away with the studio here. So thanks, Donnie, for the wide angle and high definition picture.
It looks all good, right, too. Let me tell you, it looks great.
All right. Thanks, Donnie. Be careful. Take off your headset before you start driving. Remember, don't drive and read the GPS at the same time.
I'm following him right now. He's in Chattanooga. I've got him on APRS.fi right now. You know what's fun about this is you can track him in Street View, too, and you can actually see the view as he drives by, what it looks like. So this is that's pretty amazing, isn't it?
I think that's so cool. I do not own that Volvo any longer.
It's an old picture.
I know. I'm in a rebuilt Saturn View 07. So, all right, Leo. Thank you so much for the show, it's just fascinating listening to everybody talk.
That's
the pre-show
so much fun.
Stuff's great.
It's so much fun. Well, I'm getting this AV map working here, and I got to get my this Kenwood beaconing so that I can get. I think I'm not getting to the repeater, and that's why you can't see me on APRS.fi. But we'll figure it out.
We'll get you an iGate soon. All right. Thanks, John. And wow, that was a great one. And wow, we're ready to switch over to George. Leo, we have some answers to Mind Over Megahertz quiz.
We got some good ones here. I'll tell you, we got some smart listeners to this show. Tell them, Gordon, what the question was again, just so that they know?
First question was, what's inside a 555 integrated circuit? Well, Ron K0RDP says 20 transistors, 2 diodes, and 15 resistors in the common 555. Now, last week's Brainbuster Mind Over Megahertz quiz was, okay, to figure out the length of a half-wave dipole, 492 divided by the frequency in megahertz is the length of a half-wave dipole in feet, but it really isn't. It's really 468. And the question is, where did 468 came from? And one of our listeners, Prashan Kohli, VU2CBU in Mumbai, India, says, that's an easy one. It's the K factor in calculating the dipole, just like what you and Leo did, the type of wire, stranded or solid, jacket on or off, any dirt or any bird standing on the dipole, the capacitive end effect of the insulator, and the phase angle of the angular velocity. All this makes it about 5% shorter than what would be happening in free space. And now for next week's Brain Buster, watch carefully. Susie's going to, now watch carefully. This is your Brain Buster. This is an aluminum tube, and we're going to drop this little metal object in the aluminum tube, and bingo, goes right on through. All right, this little metal object here. Now we're going to take a rare earth magnet. We're going to drop it in the aluminum tube and watch it carefully. And we want to know, because this can affect a piece of wire for grounding. This is why we don't use wire for EMI grounding, but rather a flat conductor. What is the effect that interacts between the aluminum tube and this rare earth magnet? It's somebody's law, and we want to know whose law it is for next year. There you go. That's your Brain Buster for the day.
That's very
good.
I've
got a bonus question to add.
Oh, you guys are too smart. Go ahead.
A bonus question. What is this sitting up on my shelf? What is that?
See.
I'm not going to show you a better picture of it. We're pretty high def. You should be able to see that.
It looks like
that's just a bonus question.
It looks like a Macintosh receiver to me. It looks like that.
You're so wrong.
What is that? What could that be?
Couldn't be farther from the
truth. We'll get the email, I know. I can almost read it.
Yeah.
Wow. I saw
George in there for a second. George is chomping at the bit. It's time to smoke and solder.
Yeah.
Hi, George.
Hey, everybody. Good to be here tonight. That APR stuff, our APRS stuff, was real interesting. We had a local middle school here back at the first of the summer did a balloon launch, and we tracked it with APRS and had some footage of that in the latest amateurlogic.tv.
Really?
So
okay.
Want to see more APRS, tune into amateurlogic.tv. And which episode was that, George?
The most recent one, I believe it was 31 or either 32. I don't remember the number right off, but the most recent
one. So just download
one.
That. And I mean, there's just tons and tons of information out there, but let's start there. So what about tonight in our emergency zone?
Are you not going to solder surface mount tonight?
No, but I have done that, and we'll cover that one day.
If I ever tried that, it would be an emergency, believe me.
I had some messages earlier from people saying they were looking forward to the completion of the power supply tonight. Well, since we had an emergency show, I decided to postpone that to next week. You know, yesterday was the sixth anniversary of Hurricane Katrina.
Wow.
Yeah, that thing really caused catastrophic damage when it hit the Mississippi coast and did a lot of damage all across South Mississippi. And then the levee broke, and it flooded New Orleans as well. And all communications were out on the coast when that happened, and much of South Mississippi. The cell phones, the regular telephone, electricity, the internet, even the local law enforcement agencies had no two-way radio. So ham radio rushed into the rescue immediately and established communications. And some of those operators stayed active out in the field for up to a month after the hurricane. I live 150 miles from the coast here, and Katrina was still a Category 2 when it got to Jackson. And here we had widespread power outages, telephone, cell phone loss, no internet, a very short supply of gasoline, and we eventually had food shortages. The power outage lasted 3 days at my house, and, you know, I thought it'd be a good opportunity this week to look at what I did for emergency power during the hurricane. Ground in Mississippi, I had a 5-kilowatt generator. Unfortunately, I hadn't been too good in taking care of it and keeping it maintained, so it let me down. It wouldn't crank. So I relied on 2 300-watt inverters that I had and used those with 2 vehicles. And that allowed me to run a notebook computer, a TV tuner card that I used with the computer, a small fan, and some lamps. When electricity fails and you're left sitting in the dark, the first thing you're going to need is some kind of light source. And if nothing else, a candle or a flashlight. Either one will be mighty handy while you're trying to set up your emergency power. If you're lucky enough to have a working generator, there's a few other things you're going to need. Of course, some gasoline, a good supply of that. You'll also want some oil because a lot of these generators have pressure sensors on them, and they'll shut down if they don't have enough oil pressure. You'll also want some extension cords, that goes without saying, so you can get the power inside the house. Another item that will come in mighty handy if you got an extended outage is some kind of siphon pump so that you can pump more fuel out of one of your vehicles. One more thing I like to have on hand that makes the job a lot easier is some starter fluid. Another good source of electricity during an emergency is batteries. You can use your car battery, of course. Be sure you've got some jumper cables, though, in case you run it down. Some deep cycle marine batteries are perfect for long-term power outages because they're designed to give their maximum power over a course of time rather than just cold cranking amps like a normal car battery would have. Also, jail cells are a good source of power. And UPS batteries. I like to save UPS batteries, although they might not have enough power left in them to run a 300-watt UPS supply. They'll do just fine for running a small radio, especially when you turn down the power to 5 or 10 watts. If you're using batteries, you're certainly going to need some way to charge them, and there are a lot of solar cell chargers available. You can also use a regular car battery charger for some batteries. You just want to be careful that you're using the right type of charger for the battery that you're using. Now, I found some 50-watt screw-in 12-volt bulbs. They look just like a regular house bulb, except they are designed to operate off 12 volts. Now, these come in great in an emergency. You can just screw them into a standard light fixture, and you're set to go. Of course, you're going to need some way to connect to your battery. And I've made up a little cheater cord here. It's got a couple of alligator clips on one end to clamp onto my car battery, and a standard AC outlet there on the other end I can plug my extension cord in to go to the light. Of course, during any emergency, whether you're a ham or not, you're going to want some kind of radio. And these little crank-up radios you can find at the drugstore or various places work great because you don't have to worry about having batteries charged up and ready to go. You can just charge them as you need them. Now, these have NiCad cells in them, so those will eventually go bad, but it's a good source of news and information when you really need it. Now let's talk about power inverters. That's what I used during Hurricane Katrina. I had 2 300-watt ones, and those work great for powering the small electronics that I needed. Now, these don't give really clean power, particularly these smaller ones. We found that on 2 different models, that the output voltage was only 101 to 102 volts. Also, the waveform that these generate is not a pure sine wave like you'd normally see from an AC outlet. These use a type of stepped or ramped voltage that's generated inside by the electrical components, and that's not a good clean sine wave, and there can be spikes on there. And you'll run into problems with these if you're using a power strip that has surge suppressors built in. It may be necessary to find a strip without surge suppressors, or go into the strip yourself and remove the MOVs or whatever's in there to do the surge suppression. Immediately after Katrina, my generator still wouldn't run, And I had so much luck with the power inverters, I decided to buy a larger one. So I got this 1,500-watt inverter that's going to be great the next time I really need some decent power during an emergency, and my generator won't run. Now, you have to be careful with these because even when there's no load on them, they're going to be drawing more power from your car battery than you would have with a smaller inverter. You're also going to need large cables for these inverters. You'll notice here that I've used some heavy-duty cables like would go to a high-power car stereo. And I've got some clamps on the end of it that came off a set of jumper cables, so I've got a quick and easy way to attach it to my car battery. Now, I can't get a full 1,500 watts out with these clamps here. In that case, I would want to connect directly to the battery using a lug terminal of some type. Now, most amateur radios will run off 12 volts, and rather than use a power inverter and then operate a power supply to get the 12 volts for your radio, it's best if you just get the 12 volts straight from the battery, because everything you put in between the radio and the battery is just going to draw more power. The power inverter is going to use some because it generates heat. Also, your power supply generates heat and is not 100% efficient, so you're going to have some loss in there as well. So getting your 12 volts straight from your battery source is the best way to go for powering your HF or VHF rig. Now, there's one more source of power that many of us have available to us, and I tried this out on field day a few years ago, and it worked just fine.
Yeah, N5ZNO, this is W5JX coming in loud and clear here. You're my first contact for field day. I am operating a lawnmower portable.
You'll want to use big cables to connect to the lawnmower battery and run to your rig. A smaller cable is not going to deliver the current that you need. Even if you're not a ham, everybody needs electricity in an emergency. And I hope some of these tips help prepare you for the next big event.
All right, George.
Oh, George, that's the best.
George, your next program, generator maintenance.
Yes, no kidding.
Yeah, it should be.
Look, we found all these old UPS batteries.
I'm Bob Bruniga, WB.
Hey, Bob. He snuck in there. By the way, I'm watching Don as he drives around Chattanooga in circles. In circles.
Yep,
I don't know what he's doing. Look at, he's just going around. He must be doing that for our benefit. I'm hoping he's going to spell Ham Nation if by the time he's done with that. And look what I found. Cool. George, I found a bunch of these. I was going to throw these old UPS batteries out, these old worn out batteries, but I had no, of course, there's still some juice in there, enough to run a handy talkie anyway, right?
Yeah, I mean, if you're only going to run 5 watts, those things were originally designed to, most of them, you know, 300 volt amps, so you should have plenty left in there.
Isn't that great? That's
the chat room wants to know if there's APRS on the lawnmower.
No APRS yet. I'm working on that, though.
We could do it. Well, Leo, the kids from NSFW probably want to do a show, I'm guessing.
Those kids. Get off of my lawn, you kids.
If we get those spiky-haired kids to get ham licenses.
Wouldn't that be cool?
I will know that we have been successful here on Ham Nation.
That's a good goal. We can get Brian Brushwood to get a ham license. I don't know if we want jury on the ham waves, though. I think we should just...
we have all kinds. There's room for everybody.
There's room for everyone. Well, thank you, Gary, for doing such a great job, by the way. What a pro filling in here. It's really nice to have you.
Let me plug next week a little bit. Yeah. I've been talking to Steve Bible, N7HPR. Steve is involved in a lot of interesting things in high-tech related with Tapper, the digital folks, and with the Aeris folks and the satellite people. So next week we're going to talk about two things that are currently going on. One is the Aerisat. Remember the satellite that was supposed to be a spacesuit, but now it's not a spacesuit. It's just a satellite, and they pushed it out of the space station a few weeks ago. It's still on the air, and we'll talk to Steve and find out how it's been going and what's going on. And we'll also talk about a conference that's coming up at the end of September called the Digital Communications Conference, sponsored by the ARRL and Tapper, that you're not too late to sign up for. If you really want to get high tech about ham radio. I mean, this is the blood and guts, high tech people in ham radio. This is the conference to go to. It's in a couple of weeks. It's in the Baltimore area. And you can learn more on the Tapper website, TAPR.org, and look for the DCC, the Digital Communications Conference. If you're blood and guts, if you're not blood and guts, you won't understand a thing they're saying. Trust me. I've been there. I've shot video of it. I didn't understand a thing they were saying. So that's coming up. I've got some video from the Huntsville Ham Fest that I attended while you guys were having fun during the open house. And
We did talk to the Huntsville Ham Fest because I know Ray Novak was there.
You talked to Ray. I was standing right next to him.
Yeah, that was awesome. Yeah.
Yep. And I'll be back next week because it looks like Bob will still be floating around the Mediterranean. So I'm going to enjoy one more week of Ham Nation. And I'll be back at the end of September and the beginning of October. So you're not going to get rid of me that easy.
Wonderful. Gary, thank you. And I want to wrap it up with a video that you shot for Amateur Radio Video News of a ham who I guess is a fan of Ham Nation.
Yeah, this is at the Huntsville Ham Fest. And I had a little sign up promoting at a booth I have for ARVN. I had a little sign up promoting Ham Nation. And he came up and said that he had been inactive for a long time. And because of Ham Nation, he not only is getting back on the air, he's upgraded. So let's run that video.
Here's Jim. Here you go. Let me press play.
Jim, you were just telling me something about Ham Nation and you getting back into ham radio. Tell me that story again.
Well, I hadn't been in operating for probably 30 years because, you know, other things come up in your life. And then I heard the first session of Ham Nation and Bob and Gordo and the other folks, and I kept listening, and eventually it kind of got the bug going again. And here at the Huntsville Ham Fest, with their stimulus, I went ahead and upgraded to Extra. So I'm feeling extra good today.
That's great.
So you're a brand new Extra.
I am.
Just as of yesterday.
That's right.
And you got back into ham radio because of?
Oh, Bob Heil. And of course, Leo. And Gordo. And all
and everybody.
The guys at ham.
You say everybody's name. Right. George.
Thank you, Jim. Good talking to you.
Good talking to you.
That's
thanks,
a great
Gary.
Video. I'm glad you passed that along.
Flowers for Bob.
That's great. Gordo, thank you so much. It's great video. Thanks to Don for getting that all fixed up. It looks really good.
Thank you, and I'll see you next week here on the airwaves.
73, everybody.
And I have to say this and drive somebody crazy. Over and out.
Bob Heil's going to come back from this trip. He's going to chew you out. Thank you, everybody. And we'll see you next time on Ham Nation.